A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel came back from a few weeks in the States, and he's still thinking about the little green approval that arrived in his inbox before he'd even finished packing. He's on an Israeli passport now, and this was his second trip under the visa waiver that Israel got added to. He says the significance still isn't fully appreciated there, and he feels proud and grateful to the U.S. for opening that door. But the thing that snagged his attention is the EST itself. Approval usually lands within hours, which makes him wonder whether a human being ever actually looked at it, because the volume of applicants makes that hard to picture. He wants the history, the class of travel authorization this thing spawned, and he points out that Israel has now adopted its own version, and his real question is sharper than it looks. Most countries don't levy any extra requirement on casual 90-day visitors, so when did the U.S.? Start doing this, why, and what do border authorities actually get from it that they couldn't get from the old system where airlines just enforce visa rules at the gate? Instituted this requirement, how many other countries have some early authorization layer, and what border authorities actually gain from it that they couldn't get from the old model where airlines simply enforce visa rules and people without valid visas don't travel in the first place? He also notes Israel has adopted its own version, and he's curious about that lineage.
The answer to almost every one of those questions runs through a single insight. And it's not the one most coverage leads with. ESTA isn't a security check in the way people assume. It's a liability transfer dressed up as a screening tool.
That's a strong opening claim. Walk me through it.
If you're a citizen of a country we trust, you can fly to the United States for up to 90 days without going to an embassy and getting a visa stamped in your passport. That was a huge liberalization. Before that, almost everyone needed a visa, and getting one meant an interview, a fee, a waiting period, and no guarantee. ESTA is a pre-boarding gate, not a replacement for the border interview.
So it's a permission slip to get on the plane, not a permission slip to enter the country.
When you remove the visa, you also remove the moment where a consular officer looks at the person, checks their story, checks their documents, and makes a judgment. The visa interview was a screening mechanism, and the waiver program eliminated it. Before ESTA, an airline checking in a passenger to a U.S.-bound flight had to make a judgment call. Does this person's passport look valid? Do they have a visa or a visa waiver? Do they seem likely to be admitted? Right. And nobody really thought about it that way until after September 11th. The 19 hijackers mostly entered the United States legally. They had visas. Some had tourist visas.
And airlines are famously thrilled about absorbing risk.
Screening happened at the border, if it happened at all. The commission said the government needed to push that assessment upstream, before the person even bought a ticket. It shifted the entire enforcement burden from the check-in counter to a database.
Let's go back to 9/11, because that's where the story actually starts. The visa waiver program itself dates to 1986. For two decades after that, citizens of participating countries just showed up at the airport with a passport, and the airline checked that the passport was valid, and maybe that there was an onward ticket. Let me make sure I understand the mechanism, because I think most people, including me until I looked at this, assume ESTA is basically a visa with a different name. It's not.
It's not. A visa requires an application, a fee, and in most cases, an in-person interview at a U.S. embassy or consulate. ESTA is purely digital. You fill out a form online, you pay a fee, and you get an authorization that's tied to your specific passport and valid for 2 years. It doesn't guarantee entry. The Customs and Border Protection officer at the airport still has full discretion to deny you admission. ESTA just gets you onto the plane.
So it's a pre-screen, not a permission slip. ESTA went live in August 2008, initially as a voluntary program. It became mandatory in January 2009, and the fee arrived in September 2010, $14 at the time. It's now $21, with $4 going to a travel promotion fund and $17 to DHS for border security operations.
The fee structure is honestly one of the more elegant details. $4 of every application funds Brand USA, the tourism promotion agency. They are, but their role changed. Before ESTA, an airline flying a passenger without valid entry documentation would get fined and have to fly the person back at their own expense. That was the enforcement mechanism.
A self-licking ice cream cone that also funds border security. Bureaucracy at its most efficient.
Now, Daniel's observation about speed, that approvals come within hours, sometimes minutes, and that this suggests the system can't be fully automated. That's actually backwards. The speed is the evidence that it is automated. What's not automated is the subset that gets flagged.
Explain the triage.
When you submit an ESTA application, you're providing biographical data and answering a series of admissibility questions. Criminal history, communicable diseases, prior immigration violations, travel to certain countries. The system runs that against watch lists and databases. Most applicants come back clean almost instantly because there's nothing to review. A smaller subset gets flagged for manual scrutiny. A tiny fraction gets denied. The speed most people experience is the system doing exactly what it was designed to do, clear the low-risk majority algorithmically so that human attention can focus on the exceptions.
So it's not that a human is somehow reviewing every application in 2 hours. It's that the algorithm decides. Most applications don't need human review at all, and the ones that do get held. Daniel's instinct that humans are involved somewhere is correct. They're just not involved in the part he experienced.
And that's the key insight about what border authorities gain from ESTA that they couldn't get from the old airline enforcement model. The old model was reactive. The airline looked at a passport and made a guess. If the guess was wrong, the problem was discovered at the border after the person had already traveled. ESTA makes the process proactive. The government runs the check before the traveler books the flight, before they pack a bag, before they show up at the airport. The airline's job becomes verifying that a valid authorization exists, not making an admissibility judgment.
That's also why the airline fine structure matters. Carriers face penalties of thousands of dollars per improperly transported passenger. Before ESTA, that risk was on the airline every single time. After ESTA, the airline can point to the government's own authorization and say, "You told us this person was cleared." The liability shifted.
Which brings us to the global picture, because the United States didn't invent this concept. It popularized it, it weaponized it for security screening, but the underlying idea, an electronic pre-authorization before travel, dates back further.
Australia. Australia!
Australia launched its electronic travel authority in 1996. That's 12 years before ESTA went live. But Australia's system was originally a visa waiver mechanism, not a security screening tool. It was about streamlining entry for tourists while maintaining immigration control. The innovation of the US ESTA was applying the same electronic pre-authorization concept to counterterrorism screening. That's why ESTA became the template the rest of the world copied, even though it wasn't first.
And the rest of the world has been copying it at a remarkable clip. As of 2026, at least 30 countries or territories have some form of electronic travel authorization or pre-screening requirement for visa-exempt visitors. That's a quiet revolution in border management, and most travelers experience it as a minor form to fill out.
Let me run through the major systems, because the list itself tells a story. Canada launched its ETA in 2016, New Zealand launched the NZTA in 2019, South Korea launched KETA in 2021. The United Kingdom began rolling out its electronic travel authorization in 2023, and it's been expanding through 2024 and 2025. Sri Lanka has a system. Kenya has a system. Several other countries have introduced similar schemes.
And then there's the big one still pending. The European Union's ETIS, the European Travel Information and Authorization System, which will require citizens of visa-exempt countries to obtain pre-travel authorization before entering the Schengen area. It's been delayed repeatedly. It was originally slated for 2023 or 2024. As of September 2026, it's expected to go live in 2027. €7 fee, approval valid for 3 years.
The delays are worth noting because they reveal how hard it's to build one of these systems across 27 member states with different border agencies, different databases, different privacy regulations. It's the mirror. Israel joined the U.S. visa waiver program in 2023 after years of negotiation. The deal required Israel to meet strict security and information sharing standards, and one of the conditions was reciprocity.
And then there's the one Daniel experienced firsthand. Israel's ETA, IL system, launched in 2024, initially for citizens of visa-exempt countries including the U.S., Germany, and others. Which means Daniel's experience of filling out ISTA before flying to the States is now the exact experience an American has before flying to Tel Aviv.
And that's the part I think he's picking up on when he says the significance isn't fully appreciated. Israel didn't just get added to a list, it got added to a system, and the price of entry was adopting the system itself. So the relationship is reciprocal. The U.S. opened its borders to Israelis, and Israel adopted the American screening architecture for its own borders. It's a kind of security alignment that goes beyond just travel policy.
There's something deeper here about the social contract of international travel. For most of aviation history, the presumption was that a citizen of a friendly country could visit another friendly country with minimal friction. A passport check at the border was sufficient. The post-9/11 era inverted that. Now the presumption is that everyone is a potential threat until algorithmically cleared.
And what's striking is how little public debate accompanied that shift. Travelers largely accepted it as a minor inconvenience. Fill out a form, pay $21, get an email, move on. But the underlying change is profound. The state now makes a preliminary admissibility decision about you before you've even booked a flight. That decision is made by an algorithm you can't see, using databases you can't access, and if the algorithm says no, your recourse is limited.
Daniel's point about this being an additional layer that most countries don't levy on casual 90-day visitors is well taken, but the direction of travel is clear. That's the thing about Daniel's gratitude that's worth sitting with. He's right to feel it. The visa waiver is a genuine gift. It means he can travel to the U.S. without an embassy interview, without weeks of waiting, without the uncertainty. That's real access.
And the same infrastructure that grants that access is the infrastructure that can silently exclude. The system that welcomed him is the system that can deny someone else without explanation. The government knows when you applied, where you said you were going, what you answered about your criminal history, your health, your prior travel. And the gate is invisible. That's the part that unsettles me. A physical border is legible. You can see the fence, the booth, the officer. You know where the decision happens. An ISTA denial is just an email, or not even that.
And the cost shift is real too. Vetting someone at the border is expensive. It requires a human officer, a physical location, time. Vetting someone digitally before they travel is cheap. It's a database query. Let me pull on the thread of the form itself, because I think there's something there that most coverage misses. The ISTA application asks questions that are almost identical to the old paper, I-94W. That's not a coincidence.
I want to push back on one part of Daniel's framing, though. He says it's easy to see ESD as just another part of travel, but it's actually an additional layer most countries don't levy. That's true today. And that means the form isn't a fixed document. It's a mutable interface. The paper form had to be printed, distributed, and physically updated. The digital form can be changed with a code push. The countries that don't have such a system are increasingly the ones without the infrastructure or the tourist volume to justify it.
So the question isn't whether this is an unusual additional layer. It's whether we're watching the last years of the era when it was unusual.
The form can ask whatever the state wants it to ask, and the traveler just has to answer. Some systems already collect biometric data at the border. The traveler has no leverage. If you want to travel, you answer the questions. If you don't answer, you don't travel. The form is the border, and the border can change shape.
This is where the philosophical shift really lands. The old border was a physical inspection at the frontier. The new border is preemptive authorization.
The Australia caveat matters here because it shows that the concept wasn't always about security. Australia's ETA started as a way to streamline entry for tourists while maintaining immigration control. It was about efficiency, not threat detection. The USES Tay was the pivot point where the same tool got pointed at counterterrorism. And once that pivot happened, the efficiency argument became secondary to the security argument, and the security argument is much harder to push back on.
Because who wants to be the politician who voted against screening travelers?
Right. And that's why the system spread so fast. The cost of implementing one is low. The political benefit of having one is high. The cost of not having one is being the country that didn't screen its visitors before the next attack.
Daniel's point about the volume of applicants is worth sitting with for a second. He says he can't imagine how the system could be fully automated given the volume. But the volume is exactly why it has to be. The U.S. processes millions of ESTA applications a year. There's no human workforce that could review every one of those in the time travelers expect. The only way to handle the volume is to automate the triage and reserve human review for the exceptions.
The exceptions are where the system's real character shows. Most people never see that side of it. They apply, they get approved, they fly. But the people who get flagged because of a name similarity, a prior overstay, a trip to a country on a watch list, they experience a very different system. Delays, requests for more information, denials with no clear explanation, and no obvious appeal mechanism. The frictionless experience for the majority depends on a high-friction experience for the minority.
That's the algorithmic triage in a nutshell. The system is designed to be as frictionless as possible for the vast majority, while still catching the exceptions. Daniel's experience, approval in a few hours, no friction. Is the system working as intended for someone who doesn't trip any flags?
That's not nothing. It's a genuine achievement of systems design. But it also means the system's failures are concentrated on the people least able to navigate them. If you're a citizen of a visa waiver program country with a clean record and a straightforward itinerary, ESTA is a minor formality. If you're a citizen of the same country with a name that matches someone on a watch list, ESTA is a Kafka-esque ordeal.
The privilege of the unremarkable.
That's exactly the phrase.
Let's take stock of where we are. ESTA isn't a visa. It's a pre-boarding authorization. It was created because 9/11 revealed that the old system made admissibility decisions too late and with too little information. It works by algorithmic triage. Most applicants are cleared automatically. A subset gets human review. And it shifted the enforcement burden from the airline to the government, which is why airlines quietly loved it.
It spawned a global wave. 30-plus countries now have some version of it. Israel's ETA-EL is a direct descendant. The EU's ETIS is the next big one. Australia's ETA was the precursor that proved the concept. Canada, New Zealand, South Korea, the UK, they've all built their own.
The deeper implication is that the presumption of free movement between friendly countries has been inverted. The default is now suspicion until clearance, and that shift happened with remarkably little public debate.
There's one more thing I want to flag before we move on. The ESTA fee structure. $21, with $4 going to tourism promotion and $17 to border security, is a reminder that these systems are also revenue streams. They're not just security infrastructure, they're user-funded programs. The traveler pays for the privilege of being screened, and the screening itself generates data that has value beyond the immediate security context.
The traveler pays to provide the state with data that the state uses for purposes the traveler never sees. It's a remarkable bargain when you spell it out.
Most travelers never spell it out. They just fill in the form and move on, which is, in a way, the system's greatest success. It's become invisible.
You keep saying the airlines loved it. They didn't love it at first. I worked for a travel technology company in Melbourne in the late 90s. We built the back-end booking systems for airlines running the Australia-Asia routes. When the Australian ETA launched, we had to integrate the verification checks into the reservation flow. The airlines hated it. It added a step, it created new failure points, it slowed down the booking process. There were meetings where grown men yelled about milliseconds of latency, then the fines started getting enforced properly. Before ETA, if an airline carried someone who got denied at the border, the airline ate the cost of flying them back plus the penalty. That could run thousands of dollars per passenger. After ETA, the government was making the call in advance. The airline wasn't making a judgment anymore, it was just checking a flag in a database. The liability shifted, and suddenly the same people who'd been yelling about latency were asking us to make the check faster.
That's the liability transfer I was describing, but from the inside. The airlines didn't just quietly accept it. They initially resisted it and then realized it protected them.
The U.S. copied that logic wholesale. ESTIA is Australia's liability shift with better branding. The Australians built it to streamline tourist entry and accidentally created the tool the Americans would use for counterterrorism screening. Nobody in Melbourne in 1996 thought they were building the template for global border security. We thought we were making the booking process slightly less annoying.
The accidental architect of the surveillance state.
The accidental architect of a database query that runs a few hundred times a day. My old company still has a server in a Melbourne data center handling ETA verification queries. It's running code I wrote in 1998. I checked recently. Still processing thousands of queries a day. That code has outlived three Australian governments.
Wait, you wrote the verification code in 1998 and it's still running?
Parts of it. They've patched around it over the years, but the core query logic is still mine. I was 24 years old, I didn't know what I was doing, and I wrote something that's now quietly underpinning a global system of border screening. If I'd known it'd still be running in 2026, I'd have used better variable names.
When the gap closes, the visa waiver will have become a visa by another name. The freedom it promised will have been replaced by the authorization it requires.
The funny thing is, the code doesn't know what it's doing either. It just checks a name against a database and returns a yes or a no. It has no idea it's part of a global security architecture. It's just a query.
That's the whole system in miniature, honestly. The grand security architecture is built out of small, mundane components. A database query here, a form field there, a fee structure someone designed in an afternoon. That's the thing I keep turning over. The physical border was legible. You could see it, touch it, stand at it. The digital border is invisible. It happens before you leave, and you might never know it happened at all.
The fee was my idea, by the way. Not the amount, but the idea of charging for it. I suggested it in a meeting as a joke. Someone took it seriously.
Of course they did.
Anyway, the code's still running. I don't know if that's reassuring or terrifying. Probably both.
That's a wild thought to sit with. But it raises a bigger question about where all this is heading. If ETIS goes live in 2027, and the UK's ETA keeps expanding, and more countries build their own versions, we're approaching a point where every international journey requires some form of digital pre-authorization. The era of just showing up at a border with a passport is ending.
The systems making these decisions are increasingly automated. The question is, what recourse a traveler has when an algorithm says no? With a human border officer, you can appeal, you can explain, you can show documents. With an algorithm, you get an email that says denied, and the path to challenge, it's opaque.
The next frontier is probably biometric matching and risk scoring based on travel patterns. Some systems already collect biometric data at the border. The question is whether that gets integrated into the pre-authorization layer. So the algorithm isn't just checking your answers, but also evaluating your face, your movements, your history.
Whether travelers will accept those layers as readily as they accepted Este. My guess is yes, because the convenience argument is powerful. Most people experience these systems as a minor formality, and they don't think about the architecture underneath. The friction is invisible until it isn't.
Daniel's pride in Israel's VWP inclusion is a reminder that these systems are also about access. They open doors, even as they add layers of scrutiny. For an Irish-born Israeli citizen, the ability to travel to the US on an Israeli passport without a visa is a genuine milestone. It's a recognition of a relationship.
The fact that Israel then adopted the ESTA model for its own borders shows how that recognition flows both ways. The U.S. opened a door, and Israel adopted the American screening architecture. It's a security alignment that goes beyond travel policy.
The one thing I'll take from this is that the ESTA model didn't just add a layer to travel. It changed who makes the admissibility decision, when they make it, and what the traveler has to do to be allowed to board. The border didn't disappear. It just moved earlier, into a database query that runs before you book your flight.
That database query might be running on code written by a 24-year-old in Melbourne who didn't know what he was doing, which is either the most reassuring or the most terrifying fact we've uncovered today.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running, and for the code that's apparently still running, too.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com with your own prompts and questions.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.